Back deep, the dangerous one, Saquon Barkley. And we're underway from Columbus. Barkley from inside his own five. Barkley with a lead. Barkley with a burst. Barkley down the sideline. Saquon Barkley runs the opening kick. 97 yards. Touchdown, Nittany Lions. Barkley. Barkley brings it up. Barkley's going to get a block. McSorley in front of him. Touchdown, Nittany Lions. Over the middle, caught, spinning to the end zone, Johnny D, touchdown, Buckeyes. Barrett delivers, corner throw, touchdown, Buckeyes. Johnny Dixon again, Barrett looks, fires, touchdown, Buckeyes. Marcus Ball, J.T. Barrett. McSorley in trouble. McSorley looking, fires, incomplete. And Penn State turns it over on down.
That might be 1A on the greatest wins I've ever been a part of. I don't know if I've ever been one. So much stuff went wrong, you know, from the opening kickoff to a fumble to, you know, holding penalty to, it was incredible. This is one of the most resilient teams, one of the best group of players I've ever been around. The character and who they are. Yeah, JT Barrett, you know, he'll go down as one of the, if not the great, one of the great players ever to play for the Ohio State University.
Just trying to turn the corner, play right with it, play deflecting it. Went off the back of Iguodala, and is Smith scoring again.
The Pistons are getting more confidence.
Bias Harris in the corner for Johnson, who buries it. Bias Harris running in the lane is good. Bias Harris shooting a three, and he got it. Double steps.
The most pleasing thing about the win is they didn't have a bad night. Their three guys shot the lights out. They shot 57% as a team. Those three guys shot over 60%. They had a great shooting night, and we were still able to get the win because we forced 26 turnovers, and a lot of them were forced. I thought we did a really good job there. Andre did a good job on the boards, and we just sort of hung with it. We fought and we fought and we fought. Yeah, really proud of them.
I think our defense is just, that's the number one thing. Our defense transition, our communication. I mean, we did a pretty good job at, you know, for the most part, guarding the three tonight. You know, they hit some bombs, but, you know, we were pretty much good at that. But defensively, we're just not, you know, we can't sustain, you know, and that's the number one thing.
Tonight's loss and the last couple are unacceptable. The only way we're going to be able to get out is to put the work in as players, as coaches, and we're going to do that. Well, you know, when you lose the teams, the way we've been getting beat, you know, it's unacceptable.
LSU well enough. Missed here and there.
You know, didn't protect well enough down there. Didn't run the ball well enough down there. We just didn't function very well in that area. And against a team like that, against a good football team, you just, unless you score touchdowns, very difficult to beat them kicking field goals all day.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the Extravaganza Radio on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are and will remain Toledo's sports leader. What's going on? Good Monday to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Nice montage put together of the weekend's activity by Jim Cushlin, except for the fact there was no room, Cushlin, in the montage for a 13-11 World Series game. You're telling me no room for a walk-off hit World Series game that puts the Astros on the verge of a world championship, up now 3-1 in extra innings? We couldn't fit that into the montage.
Well, not unless you wanted it 5 minutes long. I try to always keep them at about 3, and even then I was hitting about 3:30.
I didn't need to hear from both LeBron James and Tyronn Lue. They suck. The Cavaliers flat out suck. Does that mean they're a Browns level suck? No.
No, that's different. A totally different level.
Does that mean they will not get it right and make the playoffs and go on to probably be the Eastern Conference champions? No, it doesn't. All of this, but right now they suck. They don't deserve my attention, to be quite honest with you. And Jim Caldwell, the way he performed in his job yesterday, he doesn't deserve a whole lot of airtime either. I would have given a little bit of airtime to the Houston Astros, who are on the verge of blowing a $250 million payroll Dodgers team out of the World Series in five games. It could be something spectacular. In six games, beg your pardon. It could be something spectacular. And that's what I'm really hoping happens. With that all having been said, welcome to the extravaganza. Really appreciate you joining us. It's 14 minutes after 3. We got you until 5 o'clock for a couple of hours of outstanding awesome. And we have a couple of good guests coming our way as well. Coming up at 3:35, we're going to talk about that Lions loss last night to the Pittsburgh Steelers and what most of us, Kush, I think you agreed.
Yep.
Must-win situation for the Lions?
Yeah. I mean, we were kind of saying that they had to, or at least I said they had to win either that game last night or next week on Monday night in Lambeau. Have to minimum go 1-1, because then you'd be 3-5 entering the Cupcake Browns, but you don't want to be 3-5.
All I know is that this is a football team that started the season with all kinds of momentum and all kinds of possibilities and has now lost four of their last five games. Absolutely inexcusable. You know, they gave, I mean, this is how well they were playing. They gave Jim Caldwell his contract extension after, what, 2-3 weeks?
Yep.
You know, they got off to that good start. Everybody said, wow, look at this. They, you know, they beat Arizona. They beat the Giants. They lost a tough one to Atlanta. They could have won. They beat Minnesota. I don't remember exactly which week it was that they had that the decision made on Caldwell. But they're probably thinking, yeah, this is how it's supposed to be done. This is how we work in the right direction. And I'm not saying, by the way, I don't want anybody accusing me of saying Jim Caldwell should be fired because they have lost 4 out of 5. Or that because they lost in a really bad way or an ugly way to the Steelers. I'm just saying that things were going along smoothly, swimmingly, if you will, for the Lions as recently as you know, a month ago. And now 4 losses in 5 games, inexcusable, if I may say, just inexcusable. You don't lose these games that way. Because, again, we're not talking about, you know, losing to the in fact, they beat Minnesota, for crying out loud.
Yep.
The one win in that stretch was Minnesota. The losses, you know, to Carolina and New Orleans and Pittsburgh, I mean, you can't do, you know, the 4 losses that they had there, even if they just go 2-2 in those 4 losses, they're sitting in a great position to challenge the Vikings and the Packers, of course, for division dominance. So, very disappointing last night for the Detroit Lions. We will talk to Jim Caldwell. I wish we were talking to Jim Caldwell. We will talk to Jeremy Reisman of PrideOfDetroit.com about Jim Caldwell and about Ebron and about red zone football, about decisions inside the 5-yard line, about being unable to punch it in time and time again against what I have to say, by the way. Kush, did you watch it all last night, or were you watching baseball?
I was flipping around, so I didn't catch every single second of it.
You watched the second half in particular, and back-to-back trips, I think it was back-to-back, or maybe it was 2 out of 3 drives, into the Steelers, not only their red zone, but inside their 5-yard line. I got to tell you, there were some smacking and popping of pads. Look, criticism where it's due to some of the decisions made by Jim Caldwell, including going for the touchdown on 4th and 1 at a very key point in the game in the fourth quarter. But credit is due and should go to the Pittsburgh Steelers defense, which reminded me for a moment or two of the old steel curtain.
Yeah.
I say that not to be dismissive or silly or flippant. I say that. What I mean by that is it looked like they were running literally into a steel wall. Okay? I'm talking about some hitting going on down there on the goal line, on the goal line stands by the Steelers. The 1 and 4 downs in which Stafford went for it, and then they had 3 cracks at it inside the 5 the next time down, they forced a field goal. That time, after the Steelers had gotten the 97-yard touchdown pass to Juju Smith-Schuster, that, I swear to God, it was like they were running. There's a clear lane to the end zone, and then it's like an invisible barrier, an invisible clothesline. I mean, running into a wall. It's like somebody who walks through. You ever see somebody try to leave a building through a glass door, and they misjudge where the door is, and they walk face first into the glass window?
Hey, we've all seen that here and there.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, it was just like, boom. there was a steel wall there in the form of some Steelers players, Vince Williams among them, just teeth-rattling, bone-shattering hits on that goal line that would just give credit to the Steelers for that part of this. While we, you know, second-guess the decision-making by the coach for the Lions, we'll talk about that with Jeremy Reisman, but some really, really amazing hits last night on the defensive side for the Steelers. And then, obviously, that backbreaking play was the 97-yarder. Ben Roethlisberger to Juju Smith-Schuster right down the middle of the field on third and, like, eight. It was unbelievable. So we'll talk about that. And then coming up at 4:10, you also heard some of that, some of the montage from Ohio State and head coach Urban Meyer. Did you watch that on Saturday, Jim Cushing?
Wow, what a game. Incredible.
I did not see the fourth quarter live.
Oh.
I had to come back and watch it on DVR. Yeah. My wife and I had to take my son someplace when it was late in the third quarter, and Ohio State was down 15. And is got into the fourth quarter. We had to leave, and so we took off. And then after we took my son where we had to take him, we just stayed out and went to dinner. We went to dinner. We walked into the restaurant. I looked down at my phone as I go to put it away. We try not to you sit there and stare at phones when you're out to dinner. You know,
sure, of course.
Art of human interaction and communication is lost. Most people, you know, just stare at the devices. So I took my phone, I went to put it away, and I silenced it. And as I looked at the screen to silence it, I saw an alert that had come across from SB Nation. And it said, Buckeye stun Penn State coming from down 18 to win 39-38. And I could not believe what I saw. Are you kidding me? There's no way the two teams that I saw, played that fourth quarter that way. There's no way that they outscored them by 16 points in the fourth quarter. Sure enough, I went to the box, 19-3 in the fourth quarter. The Buckeyes outscored Penn State. How can that happen? I asked myself rhetorically, and then I looked at the game story. JT Barrett, 13 out of 13 in the fourth quarter alone for a $170. And three touchdowns? The much maligned? The not quite a downfield threat? The not quite an accurate enough passer?
That's the one I was just thinking of.
Who finished the game? 33 for 39? What is this? Is this flag? Is this video game? You don't do that against a Penn State team that was number two in the country. You don't do that against a team that has one of the nation's best defenses. You don't do that against a team. You don't do that in the Big Ten. You don't go 33 for 39 for nearly 400 yards and four touchdowns against, you know, I don't know, Northwestern, Indiana. Who's at the bottom of the Big Ten right now as we speak right now?
Rutgers.
Illinois. Illinois is awful. You know, Rutgers. You don't do that against them. You sure as hell don't do 13 for 13. In the fourth quarter with three touchdowns when you're down 15 against Penn bleeping State. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So we ate a little faster than my wife probably wished we would have, because I had to get home and turn on the DVR and see what in the hell I missed. And oh, my gracious.
Yeah, and out of all the things that you mentioned about, you don't do that against Penn State, you didn't even mention Saquon Barkley. For me, Bob, yeah, I was watching this, but I was pretty getting disappointed, because when Saquon Barkley got his second touchdown, first offensive touchdown, because of course he opened the game.
36-yarder?
I'm thinking, oh, it's 21-3. Unbelievably, I think this is over. Well, yeah, shows what I know.
I did too. So I think almost everybody did. Almost everybody did. They're not going to be able to deal with Saquon Barkley, and they're not going to be able to, you know, to outscore this team. And sure enough, let's just say this. Who led Penn State in rushing yards in this game, Cush?
Not
it wasn't
Saquon
Barkley. It was Trace freaking McSorley.
Right.
I mean, Saquon Barkley, the Heisman Trophy candidate, the Heisman Trophy winner, according to a lot of people, as recently as a week ago. 21 carries? 44 yards? 36 of those 44 coming on one run?
Right, right.
That's 2.1 a carry, but that's if you take the one run away. And just look at the rest of the game, 20 carries, 8 God-blasted yards. That's what they held Saquon Barkley to. Let me say that again in case you didn't hear it. 20 carries for 8 yards. Yes, they had one carry for 36. They let him have, but the rest of them, 20 for 8. Trace McSorley led the way on the ground with 13 carries for 49 yards. That defensive performance, coupled with JT Barrett, 33 for 39, 328, 4 touchdowns, nary an interception, and oh, by the way, for good measure, he led his team in rushing, but for 95 very important yards, 17 carries, 95 yards, many of those on big-time first-down runs. JT Barrett went from the guy who was a Heisman candidate 3 years ago to a guy who had kind of a forgettable comeback season the next year when Cardale Jones kind of took half the job from him, to a guy who last year took a giant step backwards, to a guy this year that not a lot of people had faith in, especially after the Oklahoma game, to being the best player in college football for one day. For one day. Forget about Saquon. Forget about Lamar Jackson. Forget about Sam Darnold. Forget about Josh Rosen. Forget about any of the great players. For one day and one day only. For a day of 33 out of 39 for 328 and 4 scores, JT Barrett was the best player in college football. For a day. For a 3.5 hour period. That was an unbelievable thing to behold. So we've got, we're going to talk about that a little bit more and get the perspective with from Chris Lauterbach from 11warriors.com, the Ohio State website. Very much looking forward to that. And with all of that happening, we have no time really to even talk about the horrific Cavs who have lost to, help me out here, the Nets, the Pelicans, and the Knicks.
And don't forget the Magic, too.
Three non-playoff teams. The Magic, too. But I'm talking about in a row. It's three in a row, right?
Yes.
They lost to Magic, and then they won, beat somebody.
Chicago.
Chicago, thank you. Okay, so three in a row against those teams, non-playoff. They've lost now 4 games, though, to non-playoff teams. That's a story, if we had time to talk about that story. What else is a story? The Pistons, who are rolling out of the gate, the exact opposite of the Cavaliers, and they took down the defending champion Warriors, who have now lost 3 games in this young season, which... If somebody had told you that the Cavs and the Warriors would combine for 7 losses in the first 2 weeks of the basketball season.
Or how about this? Even though the week got the season got started early, I would phrase it. What would you say if I told you the Cavs and Warriors were combined for 7 losses before November?
Yeah, there you go. Any way you look at it, just incredible. Incredible, impossible, but that's where it is. And then, meantime, they played a little baseball last night down in Houston, down in H-Town, where. We all know that they have just been, you know, ravaged by that storm, by Hurricane Harvey, that just dumped monumental amounts of water, flooding, historical levels of flooding, not just for Houston, but for the continental U.S. And they really, really needed something to lift them up, to lift their spirits, to help them deal. And that's what sports is for in so many ways. And how about the performance the Astros are giving to those very, very, you know, those struggling fans, those fans and residents and people, good people down there in Houston who have been suffering. What are the Astros doing to the L.A. Dodgers? What are they poised to have Justin Verlander do in Game 6 to close out their first World Championship?
That's true. It is going to be Verlander tomorrow
night.
Yes,
it is. It's going to be Verlander tomorrow, and he is going to try to prove why. He was worth it. I don't remember what the hell they gave Detroit. What they give Detroit doesn't matter. At the waiver trade deadline, he is going to try to seal the whole thing, and my money is absolutely on him, even though this has been a very home field dominated series and postseason overall. I will put Verlander on the mound in Los Angeles and take my chances. Last night, I will say this, however, if I might. Last night's Game 5 result. Some are calling it one of the greatest postseason games ever played. Some are saying that. When you are able to put together a game with 25 runs, 13-12, and you go extras, and you start out with a pitching matchup, which is supposed to be brilliant, between Clayton Kershaw and Dallas Keuchel, rematch of Game 1, and you expect 1-0, 2-1, 3-2, and you get 13-12, you get crazy home runs, you get crazy offense, you get a walk-off hit to drive in the winning run for the home crowd. When you get all of that, some are saying it was one of the greatest World Series games ever played. While I am thrilled for the Astros, and while the drama of an extra innings win and a walk-off win certainly do lend to that argument, I got to tell you, 25 runs, 5.5 hours to play it, 28 trips to the mound. I don't remember the exact number of pitching changes made. Is that really how baseball is supposed to decide its championship? Is that really how baseball is supposed to be played? It was just very, very different, and as a lot of these postseason games have been. And I have to tell you, some of that for me is a little over the top. I'm not liking 25 runs. I'm not liking juiced baseballs. I'm not liking 28 trips to the mound. Let them play baseball instead of overanalyzing and overmanaging and over everythinging every single aspect of the game. I kind of want the players to get back to playing baseball in a timely manner. 5.5 hours for a 10-inning game? Is that really? And I know they put extra spots into the spot breaks. The commercial breaks are a little longer in between half innings because it's the World Series, and I understand that's going to drag a normal game that might be 3 hours and 5 minutes and push it into the 3.5 hour range. And maybe if you allow for certain circumstances, it's going to be pushing into the 4 hour range. 5.5 hours is not how baseball is supposed to be played. 1:15 our time is when that thing ended last night. I'll give a cookie to everybody who stayed up and watched every pitch. That's not fun, as far as I'm concerned. You might like all the run scoring, and I do to a degree, but 13-12 in those circumstances, the way that I just described them, not exactly what I would consider one of the greatest World Series games ever played.
And that's an interesting argument to have, you know, for especially down the line, if baseball should do anything to make the playoff games especially, you know, run smoother. I mean, I think we had a wild stat a couple weeks ago where we mentioned that these playoff games, and this was only after the division series round, even then they were averaging almost 1/2 hour longer than any of the than regular season games.
Right. Right, which we knew. I mean, like yep. I said, there's reasons for that, but this is a little bit too much.
Yeah, this almost carried away. And everything that you're talking about, it actually it means you're almost overlooking the fact of, this is why, by the way, side note, this is why I said on that whole Clayton Kershaw conversation after game one, get back to me at the end of the series, he more or less got rocked around.
I'm going to talk about him. I'm going to talk about him and his legacy, his status among the all-time greats, because we did exactly that before, Jim, and I've got a lot to say about him. But first, because it's 3:32 and we want to get into a few other things, including football, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
And your Wild Stat of the Day does indeed have to do with those runs. A 3-2 series lead for the Astros following the 13-12 win. That 25 total runs scored, tied for the second most ever in a World Series game, tied with Game 3 of the 97 series, Marlins and Indians, that was 14-11. The only World Series game to score more, 29. In Game 4 of the 93 World Series, where the Blue Jays edged the Phillies in a pitcher's duel 15-14. How about that? That is a wild stat indeed. All right, we'll get a timeout here. Bottom of the hour, local sports center coming your way. Then we talk Lions and Steelers. You wanted to say Tigers and Bears, but no. We're going to talk Lions and Steelers coming up. Jeremy Reisman, Pride of Detroit.com, joins us next right here on The Ticket.
Ganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know, didn't protect well enough down there. Didn't run the ball well enough down there. We just didn't function very well in that area. And against a team like that, against a good football team, you just, unless you score touchdowns, very difficult to beat them kicking field goals all day.
Yeah, but you probably could have beaten them kicking field goals all day if you had had enough of them at the right times. And that's one of the big things that Jim Caldwell is being called to the question for in the aftermath of the Lions' fourth loss in their last five games. What started out as a very, very strong season with a lot of very high expectations here in the middle of the season is turning south in a hurry. And now, if we thought Pittsburgh was a must-win game, well, you pretty much better guarantee that that's exactly what Green Bay is. You do get the soft part coming up after that with Cleveland and maybe Chicago before Minnesota again, who will be looking as they have a 2.5 lead, by the way, over the Lions in the division, perhaps to put them away for good. Joining us now to talk more about the Lions' loss to the Steelers last night is Jeremy Reisman, who is the, what do we call you? You run the page, direct the page, manage the page, edit the page of PrideOfDetroit.com, Jeremy?
The official title is managing editor, but you can call me whatever.
I got two of them right then. I said manage and edit, so managing editor.
Go.
So I think that works. All right. And you probably direct it and run it, too, so you're all of those things. anyway, thanks for the time. So, you know, I said this before you came on. You give credit where it's due, and you give critique where it's due. I have to give credit. While people are going to bury Jim Caldwell for a few things with respect to the play calling and decision making inside the 5-yard line on a couple of different drives, very big drives by that offense. That'll be the critique part. You got to give credit to that Steeler defense. Some of those hits down there on the goal line were absolutely teeth rattling. I mean, the Lions didn't necessarily blow it as much as they tried to power it in a few different times, and the Steelers' defense was just like, you know, the proverbial steel curtain. It was like running into a wall the way they played defense there. So how much credit do you give Jeremy versus how much criticism you give Jim Caldwell and the Lions for their execution, not only in the red zone, but obviously inside the 5-yard line?
I mean, I guess it really just kind of depends on your point of view, because you're absolutely right. The Steelers deserve a ton of credit for the way they played, and I think that fourth down play to Dwayne Washington really speaks to your point about those kind of bone-crushing hits.
Yeah.
You know, Washington had a lane there. He just had to beat a couple guys one-on-one, couldn't do it. And, you can blame that on Dwayne Washington. Maybe he shouldn't have even been the guy in there. We've seen Amir Abdullah in that Minnesota game had a goal line touchdown. He, interestingly, didn't have a red zone touch this game. I think if that's maybe a lot of people are complaining about predictability in the red zone, but, yeah, you know, running that close to the goal line is commonplace, essentially. So you just have to beat your team one-on-one. They know it's coming. You know it's coming. Good teams win those matchups. And if there was a mistake that the Lions made, I think, on Sunday night, I think it was with personnel choices.
I think that is fair to say. What about just the overall inability? I mean, when you march down the field as often as the Lions did to the tune of 480-some yards of offense, and you come away with just field goals, that's a pretty depressing thing. You should have had at least two or three touchdowns. What is it? I mean, has it been a season-long thing as far as the red zone? Did they just tighten up in this particular game, become conservative and, as you say, predictable when they get down close? Because, I mean, there was really nothing that they wanted to do that they couldn't do in between the 20s in this game.
Yeah, they actually came into this game, I think, according to Football Outsiders, somewhere around 7th or 8th in the league in points per red zone trip. So this is kind of a newer problem. They actually started out the year, I think, in their first, seven red zone trips. They had scored 7 touchdowns in it. But recently, this was a problem against the Saints, and I think even going back to the Panthers game a little bit, this was a problem. So it's certainly something that's coming up, and I think a lot of it really has to do with the lack of that short yardage running situation. Every team likes to run it when they're in third and two or third and one. The Lions are just really, really bad at it. They're converting, I think, at about a rate of 60% on third and fourth and one, which is actually really, really bad. You know, you want to be converting at least 80% of the time in third and fourth and one situations. And when you get down to the goal line and there's not a lot of room to toss the ball, you want to rely on that running game. And right now the Lions just don't have a good short yardage running game, and it's proving costly.
Of course, it's not just the short yardage running game, although that's a big, big part of it, clearly. But they also had other chances. For example, big play to Golden Tate late, big play, and then just inexplicably drops the ball, not the pass. It would have been better had he dropped the pass. Instead, he catches the pass, makes a football move, and then just drops it. Didn't strip, just dropped it, an unforced fumble at the Steelers 24 with a chance to go, you know, to go in there for the go-ahead touchdown. Those are just those kinds of things, a few crucial drops or non-catches by Ebron, which we can talk about as well. Those are just execution plays that I don't know. Is that an indication that maybe they're just not as good or as good at the right times as maybe you know, some people thought they would be?
I think that's, you could certainly make a case for that, because it wasn't just, you know, the Golden Tate fumble. It wasn't just a couple Ebron drops. A couple times the Lions got within the Steelers 30, they started getting penalties. There was a holding penalty, I think, on a first and goal from the 10. I think it was the very first drive of the game. They marched all the way down the field and then had back-to-back false starts that drew them back, had to settle for a field goal there. Marvin Jones dropped a sure touchdown on a fade route in the very last drive of the game. There's a lot of problems with this offense right now, and it isn't just a short yardage running game. It isn't just play calling. It isn't just Ebron dropping passes. There are a lot of issues going on right now, and honestly, this is something that the Lions have really dealt with for over a year. Last year, I think people forget that the Lions offense wasn't as nearly as consistent as it should have been, and it seems like those problems are persisting, which could be a personnel issue, could be a coaching issue. It's hard to kind of tell from the outside looking in, but it's definitely a widespread issue, and one I don't think the Lions necessarily can change in 1 week.
We're talking to Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com, about the Lions' loss to the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's their fourth loss in five games. This is just a really, you know, goofy thing to ask, but because I'm not suggesting that they made a mistake or that they should fire Jim Caldwell because they've lost four out of five, but it is interesting that they got off to the really good start and suddenly the Caldwell question was answered. They went ahead and gave him the extension, and then right after that, things have kind of fallen off again and gone south. So the question, I guess, is do you think anybody up in the front offices are questioning the decision to give him that extension they gave him about a month and a half ago?
That's a good question to have. The one interesting note to make, though, is that the extension was actually done in the offseason. They just kind of chose to leak it right after that 2-0 start. Or I don't know if they chose to leak it, but it came to the surface once the Lions had that 2-0 start. You kind of think that maybe they purposely leaked it right around that time just for PR purposes. But I think with a guy like general manager Bob Quinn, he's always evaluating. You know, he's never complacent. He's never at a point where he's like, okay, I think I made the right decision. You know, if you're a good general manager, you're always questioning your decision. You're always looking to see where you can improve. So I think it's certainly the case where Jim Caldwell's job isn't necessarily safe at the end of the year, even though he just signed an extension. If the Lions don't show up, I'm not saying they have to win the division at this point. I feel like at the way things are right now, that's kind of a long shot. But if the Lions don't compete down the stretch, you know, the final nine games here, I wouldn't necessarily say Jim Caldwell is a safe, you know, is completely off the hot seat.
Interesting. Very interesting. And thanks for the point of clarification, by the way, about when the thing was agreed to and when it was announced. We're talking to Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com. Lions lost to the Steelers last night 20-15, a game that perhaps they should have won. Big play, 97-yard touchdown after a goal line stand on four straight downs by the Steeler defense. Juju Smith-Schuster goes 97 from Ben Roethlisberger right up the gut, or right down the middle of the field, that would be. Jim Cushman's got a question for you, Jeremy.
Yeah, and kind of in a similar vein, you know, you guys were just talking about, is this possibly, if it keeps going, cost Caldwell anything, even with the extension? Well, they've lost three out of four, as we mentioned, four out of five, I should say, and three of them are in a row. So now you have a team that is 3-4 right now. It's at Lambeau next Monday, a week from today, before you get a little bit of a reprieve against the Browns. How must-win is that game? Because suddenly a very, very promising season. It was at one point 3-1 in addition to the 2-0. Now is kind of up in the air in a division that feels still winnable because of things like Aaron Rodgers not being there for those Packers. How must-win, if at all, is this one coming up?
It's interesting. I think you guys asked me the same question with the Saints game, and I told you I don't really like to use that term this early in the season, but I'm using it this Monday. This is absolutely a must-win game for the Lions. You know, right now as it stands, they need to be 7-2 down the stretch to reach just 10-6. And if they lose next week against the Packers, not only are they three full games behind the Vikings because next week is their bye, they're going to be two full games behind the Packers. And I don't think we should quite bury Green Bay yet, but if the Lions are, you know, two games behind at least two teams after 10 weeks, after 9 weeks, 10 weeks, they're basically in a hole that would be unbelievable to come out of. And, you know, there would be no reason to expect the Lions to do so, riding a four-game losing streak against the Browns. And who knows? I mean, the Browns competed for three quarters, at least, against the Vikings, and they're going to be hungry for a win coming out of their bye. So if the Lions don't win on Monday night next week, which is going to be a hard game regardless of whether Aaron Rodgers is playing or not, in Lambeau Monday night, not an easy W by any means. But if they don't come away with a win there, then I think you can start looking at the draft.
I think you're 100% right. I mean, I think that Green Bay game certainly becomes must-win. Even though we were talking about it earlier, you're right to certainly say that now. But by the way, the Browns saying, "Come on," I mean, that's, you know, you don't have to humor anybody with that. Okay, that is like some high school's freshman football team taking the field against a varsity team on a Friday night. They are an absolute embarrassment and a joke. And I don't care what they did in London for 2.5 quarters. They lost by 2 touchdowns, and it's what they should do. They're 1-23 in their last 2 seasons, and I want to say, what is it, Jim, now, like 5-43 or something stupid in their last 48 games? So we don't even reference that team anymore. Let me ask you about Ebron. A lot of trade talk, a lot of poor performance, and every time he gives a poor performance, every time he drops one or just doesn't catch one, even if it doesn't qualify as a drop, but a play that maybe a good tight end makes, the fans at Ford Field go off on him, and he essentially said after the game, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't have his quotes in front of me, but he essentially said, you know what, if they want to trade me, then they'll trade me, and if they don't, then we'll do the work here, and whatever happens, happens. So what's going on there? Do they need to part ways with him?
Well, I mean, if fan perception matters to the Lions at all, then yeah, they absolutely do, because he's certainly at a point of no return with the fan base. There's no winning back over the fans. I don't see anything short of setting the tight end receiving records over the next 9 games, winning over Detroit fans at this point. The problem I see, though, is that the Lions don't really have a good set of tight ends behind them. Darren Fells is, you know, he's been an okay blocker and maybe a little bit better at receiving than Ebron, but we saw Michael Roberts get a little bit of extra playing time last night, and he did not look very good. He did not look ready. You know, the rookie out of Toledo, as you guys, I'm sure, are well aware. He still looks like he's a couple weeks away from really even, you know, competing on a professional level. And then those are the only two tight ends that they have on the roster. So if the Lions are interested in trading Ebron, I wouldn't be surprised to see them get a tight end in return, to be honest. I think they have one guy on the practice squad, but he doesn't have any experience either. So, tight end is an important position on this team. We've seen them have these red zone struggles, and Ebron was supposed to be that guy. Michael Roberts was supposed to be that guy. They clearly don't have that guy right now, and if they're going to trade Ebron, there's really no point in doing it unless you're getting a guy like that in return.
Yeah, and I'm very disappointed for Michael Roberts. I don't want to say in, because that's kind of mean. Disappointed for him, because you're right, he's a Toledo guy, and he was a lot more reliable, was he not, Jim Cushman, with the Rockets? I mean, very dependable hands, a playmaker, a guy who can catch the ball in the red zone and do the things like you're talking about, Jeremy, that Ebron is not doing, and it's just it's not there for him right now, at least not yet. So, but I do have the quote here. Ebron said, "I mean, it is what it is. They got till Tuesday. It's a business. If they feel like they want to cut ties with me, then they cut ties. If they feel like they can continue to use me and my skills and my abilities, then blank, let's do it." And I'm assuming that word starts with an S or an F. So he's not really thrilled about it. And then asked which way that he thought the Lions were leaning, he said, "What's my gut tell me? My gut tells me to go home and get something to eat. I'm starving." So he's just being real kind of, you know, chill about it, not saying I really want out of here, but not saying, this is where I want to be and I will improve my play and I will win people back over. He's just kind of like very casual about it. And is it a distraction for this team right now, do you think?
I mean, I can see how it would be a distraction for Ebron just to see all those reports out there. You know, Pro Football Talk was throwing out the words that, you know, they'd be shocked. I don't remember the exact words, but they basically said, you know, this is almost a sure thing that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can't imagine if Ebron saw that before the game last night, what he would be thinking. But, you know, the trade deadline is Tuesday, so it'll be behind the team whether Ebron's with them or not by then. And to me, it sounds like Ebron's willing to just kind of accept fate as it falls and is just kind of waiting like everyone else at this point. So we'll see in 24 hours. But at this point, I kind of expect some sort of deal to happen, but I also wouldn't be 100% surprised if the Lions decided not to.
We kind of talk about this every time we have you on, so we might as well do it again. Based on where we are now at the halfway point, you know, with most teams playing 8 games already, that's it's literally midseason. Once again, who's the best team in the NFC? Is it still the Eagles?
Yeah, I think it is. I until they give me a reason not to say the Eagles, I think it's the Eagles. It's interesting, though. There are a lot of teams that are starting to distance themselves. The Vikings are one of those teams. The Seahawks are a team that I've really been doubting all year. I thought they came out slow, but little that I remember that this is what happens every year with Seattle. They start out slow and then suddenly they pick things up, and I believe they're either 5-2 or 6-2 now. So they deserve to be part of the conversation as well. 5-2.
But you know what? It's a very interesting 5-2. We all saw how that game came out yesterday. It was a shootout. It was a barn burner when rookie Deshaun. Now I shouldn't say this casually because Deshaun Watson is tearing everybody up. In fact, I think he set a record now for the most touchdowns in his first 7 games as a pro in NFL history. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. But when you let a rookie that's a guy I can see Deshaun Watson doing that against you know, some defenses, but the Legion of Boom, as it was once known, for them to allow him to throw for 450 and 4 touchdowns and have to win on a Russell Wilson and maybe a bad coach, talking about Jim Caldwell, maybe a bad Bill O'Brien decision trying to salt the game away with Lamar Miller on the ground instead of letting Deshaun Watson make a play. And then Russell Wilson comes back. But they had to rely on Russell Wilson to win that game, did the Seahawks. That defense isn't what it always was. That's the reason I feel like the gap between 1 and 2, if those are the top two in the NFC, might be somewhat significant.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point to make. The Seahawks also, you know, they had 3 interceptions that game. And to me, what's surprising about the Seahawks is that they're able to put up that many points without a running game. The style of their offense has always been kind of pound the rock and then Russell Wilson will take care of the rest in terms of like play action, things like that. Russell Wilson threw for 452 yards this game and only had 33 yards of rushing to deal with. So, they're definitely changing their identity both on offense and on defense. You're absolutely right that they're not really the Legion of Boom anymore, but the fact that they can now win shootouts is something that's fairly new in Seattle. So, it'll be interesting to see if they kind of change complete identities for the entire year.
You just got a taste of the Steelers, who are 6-2, tied for the best record in the AFC. New England is also 6-2, but won a very humdrum game, if you will, against the Chargers, 21-13, only got one touchdown, and lost Chris Hogan, I guess, now. He's got a shoulder injury. They continue to lose receivers and pieces and parts. I don't know how long they can keep that glued together. Of course, if anybody can, Belichick can, but do you have a sense on who the best team in the AFC is?
I'm still kind of holding on to the Chiefs. I know they're on this 2-game losing streak. That Thursday night game against the Raiders was kind of fluky to me. To me, they're just the most well-rounded team. You know, Kareem Hunt is killing it there in the running game. Alex Smith is having a career year. And that defense, while not as good as it could have been, you know, with Eric Berry out for the year, it's still very good. And so to me, that's just a very well-rounded team, just kind of like the Eagles in the NFC. They do everything well, and that's rare in the NFL.
Good stuff, as always, from Jeremy Reisman, prideofdetroit.com. Not a lot of pride last night. Well, you'd be proud of Detroit, but just not the Lions' effort, particularly in the red zone last night. Jeremy, keep up the great work. Thanks very much for the time. We'll catch up with you again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you. You got it. Jeremy Reisman joining us here on the Extravaganza. We're going to talk college football after the top of the hour Sports Center, top of the hour local Sports Center with Kush coming your way. College football by way of the Ohio State Buckeyes, and that's my way of segueing into the border battle contest yet again. We get ever closer to the Ohio State-Michigan game, this time up in Ann Arbor, and the ticket and Yingling want you to attend. We got a chance for you to go to the Ohio State-Michigan game with limo service from Total Image Limousine. It's November 25th in Ann Arbor. The runner-up prize is a trip for 2 to the Big Ten Championship game, December 2nd at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. If you want to qualify, get on our website, 1065theticket.com. Register one time there or text the word Border Battle to 64636. Once again, that short code, 64636. Those who qualify will attend our giveaway party Thursday night, November 16th at the Blarney downtown. And that's all brought to you from Yingling, the true house of Munch, Get-Go Transportation, Churchill's, Country Hearth, Tass Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your football freaks here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. All right, so we're going to get that top of our Sports Center that I mentioned. Then we're going to talk more college football because it was a game. Well, it was probably the game of the year in college football. May remain the game of the year by the time it's done, and that's saying something. The battle between two top 10 teams in Columbus on Saturday, late afternoon, Buckeyes with just a monumental comeback, simply a season changer maybe for both of those teams and beyond. With the playoff announcements coming soon to see who the top four teams are according to the committee, that game was just massive. Chris Lauterbach, 11warriors.com, that's a Buckeye website. He will join us next right here on The Ticket.
Here,
you know, didn't protect well enough down there. Didn't run the ball well enough down there. We just didn't function very well in that area. And against a team like that, against a good football team, you just, unless you score touchdowns, very difficult to beat them kicking field goals all day.
Just trying to turn the corner, play right with it, play deflecting it. Went out the back to Iguodala, and Ish Smith scoring again. Pistons are getting more confidence. For Johnson, who buries it. Bias Harris, runner in the lane, is good. Bias Harris shooting a three, and he got it. Double step. It's over with another steal.
The most pleasing thing about the win is they didn't have a bad night. Their three guys shot the lights out. They shot 57% as a team. Those three guys shot over 60%. They had a great shooting night, and we were still able to get the win because we forced 26 turnovers, and a lot of them were forced. I thought we did a really good job there. Andre did a good job on the boards, and we just sort of hung with it. We fought and we fought and we fought. Yeah, really proud of them.
Back deep, the dangerous one, Saquon Barkley. And we're underway from Columbus. Barkley from inside his own five. Barkley with a lead. Barkley with a burst. Barkley down the sideline. Saquon Barkley with the opening kick. 97 yards. Touchdown, Nittany Lions. Barkley. Barkley breaks it up. Barkley's going to get a block. McSorley in front of him. Touchdown, Nittany Lions. And blocked. Loose. Booker has it. And Ohio State's in business at the Penn State 40. Barrett. Over the middle.
In trouble. McSorley looking. Fires. Incomplete. And Penn State turns it over on down.
That might be 1A on the greatest wins I've ever been a part of. I don't know if I've ever been what so much stuff went wrong. You know, from the opening kickoff to a fumble to, you know, holding penalty to it was incredible. This is one of the most resilient teams, one of the best group of players I've ever been around. The character and who they are. Yeah, JT Barrett, you know, he'll go down as one of the, if not the great, one of the great players ever to play for the Ohio State University.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. The extravaganza rolls on now at 15 minutes after 4. We got 45 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you. Nothing was as awesome as the 15 minutes that they put together on Saturday in Columbus. The fourth quarter for the Buckeyes was just one for, you know, it's old cliche to say one for the ages. But honestly and truly, just a historic day for JT Barrett. I said this in the opening of the show today. For 3.5 hours, or maybe for the second half, but just overall, if you look at the numbers, for one afternoon, JT Barrett was the best player in college football. I'm not saying he is the best player in college football, but for one afternoon, he was. And I'm trying to figure out what the most impressive thing about that comeback win was. Simply unbelievable. We're going to talk in more college football as we continue this afternoon here on the Extravaganza. So let's bring in Chris Lauterbach now. Chris writes and does a lot of work for the outstanding Buckeye website, 11warriors.com. He joins us now once again right here on The Ticket. Chris, good to have you back, man. How are you?
Doing well. How about you, sir?
Man, I'm great. Really, really great. I'm trying to make some sense of the numbers because there are two sets of numbers, Chris, that I can't wrap my brain around. Technically, there's three sets of numbers, and I'm going to give them all to you, and I'm going to ask you what is the most impressive among them. The first one will be the fourth quarter numbers that JT Barrett put up when you come into the quarter down 15 and you have to outscore the other team by 16 to win, and it's exactly what they did, 19-3 in the fourth. JT Barrett was 13 out of 13, not one errant throw, 170 yards and three touchdowns. Simply remarkable for the fourth quarter alone. But you say, well, he just got hot. Well, then he was hot all afternoon because his grand total, only six incompletions out of 39, 33 for 39, 328 and four touchdowns. Those are two sets of the numbers that I want to give you. And then, Chris, the other one is 20 for 8. And I'm talking about Saquon Barkley, who ran the ball 20 times, the Heisman Trophy perceived winner by a lot of people. He's just a projected winner. He carried the ball 20 times for a grand total of 8 yards. Now, yes, he had one other carry in which he went for 36 and a touchdown, and I'm going to give him that. But on the other 20 carries, the Buckeyes bottled up the Heisman guy, the guy that before the game people were talking about looks like a cross between Bo Jackson and Billy Sims or something stupid. Saquon Barkley, 20 carries for 8. So what performance was most impressive to you? The job that JT Barrett was able to turn in or the job that Buckeye defense was able to do against Saquon Barkley?
I think I need to give the nod to JT Barrett here. I think obviously bottling up Barkley was a heck of an effort by the defensive front. I think that was maybe a little bit more plausible or potentially expected, just because Barkley, as good as he is, I think he's really done a lot of his damage on kick return and as a receiver. I mean, he's really emerged as a big-time receiver this year, but there's been some games where he has kind of disappeared a little bit running the ball, so I was less surprised with that and maybe more surprised and really just thrilled for Barrett that in a big game, finally, after all the, you know, all the stuff he's taken, despite always being the best option for Ohio State under center, for him to go 33 of 39 with three drops, is really just, you know, unfathomable for most fans and just, you know, a spectacular performance.
Well, to your point about Barkley, we'll come back to JT. To your point, his rushing totals this year do include 172, 88, 47 in a blowout win over Georgia State, no big deal, 211 against Iowa, 56 against Indiana, 75 against Northwestern, 108 against Michigan, and then, as I mentioned, 44 for the Buckeye, or against the Buckeyes. But the difference is in a lot of those games, as you point out, he did a lot of his damage through the air, catching the ball for 142 yards, 94 yards, 53 yards. You add those, you know, put up those yards from scrimmage, and that's how he kind of, you know, has made himself the would-be, could-be, might-be, probably will-be a Heisman winner. But against the Buckeyes, the defense didn't just bottle him up there. He only caught the ball four times for 23 yards. So that's a grand total of 67 yards from scrimmage, easily his season low. So what were the Buckeyes able to do to keep him under wraps in all ways?
Well, I think it all starts up front with the defensive line. I mean, whether they were trying to stop the run or maybe just disrupt timing in the pass, they were so much pressure on McSorley, just overwhelmed Penn State's offensive line. I think that was obviously critical to the success and really maybe changed how Penn State was trying to attack, especially after they had a lineman go down and kind of had to reshuffle. Mm-hmm. Reading a couple Penn State sites and whatnot, they talked about how the offensive line was a little bit of a weakness and really had no depth, and I think that depth got exposed on Saturday night.
That's a very interesting point, but just an amazing job, amazing game plan and execution by you know, and what's weird, you know, when you think about the Buckeye defense, they gave up a grand total of 38 points. And you would think if Penn State puts up 38 at the horseshoe, Saquon probably went off. And he didn't. I mean, you know, you do talk about the kick return to start it, but Trace McSorley led them in rushing with 49 yards, and he only threw for 192. It's like, where did those 38 points come from? So let's go back to the team that got 39. You're right about JT, much maligned, criticized heavily after the loss to Oklahoma, because if you look back at his history, Chris, which you know obviously very well for working with the 11 Warriors, you know, it was 3 years ago, and people joke about this being his 12th year in college football. 3 years ago, he was a Heisman contender, and probably, had he not gotten hurt, would have found his way to the Heisman stage as one of the finalists. Then he has a year, the next year, in which he splits duty with Cardale Jones. Then he has the job all back to himself last year, but takes a real big step backwards compared to where he was before. And then he loses to Oklahoma early on this season, and people said, man, Barrett is just not the guy. And, you know, even in the blowout wins over the last 5 weeks, it's like, well, those are overmatched teams. What does it say about the resilience and the maturity of this kid? I guess I can say this grown man now. Again, he's a fifth-year senior. He's 22 years old. But what does it say about him to have this game at this time, especially that quarter, against number two in the country, with the committee, the playoff committee, about to release their first rankings very shortly, and the Buckeyes needing that win over the second-ranked team in the country to overcome the Oklahoma loss and maybe get back up where they were? What does it say about JT Barrett's resilience that he was able to do that?
I think it says a lot, obviously. I mean, here's a guy that, you know, as you mentioned, had just taken a lot of criticism for all angles, but despite all the doubt about him, I don't think he ever lost any belief in himself. And I think really he understood and would never vocalize that it was much bigger than him. Yes, he regressed a little bit as a passer last year, even, you know, compared to the year before that. But, you know, here's a guy that's had three offensive coordinators, I think, now since he's been here. The offensive line last year, the right side, was unbelievably shaky. I mean, Isaiah Prince, you know, was a turnstile in big games last year. And you had a wide receiving core that, you know, really didn't have much after Michael Thomas left to really depend on. And all that stuff kind of had to come together. But, you know, as he knew, the quarterback gets way too much credit and way too much blame. And in a lot of cases last year, it was on the blame side.
Yeah, no question. And you know, he's very mature. He acknowledges everything you just said. You know, I know that after wins, I'm probably going to get way more credit than I deserve. And after losses or poor performances, I'm probably going to get more blame than I deserve. It comes with the territory. I guess that kind of shows that maturity. And how much does that rub off on some of the new guys, particularly when you lose, you know, a Curtis Samuels and you're trying to replace playmakers and he's got to figure out a way to, you know, to get these guys involved and to make them step their games up. That ability, that kind of leadership, I guess, is something you don't teach. You know, you have to have it, and you have to learn it and develop it and grow it through your own experiences.
Well, and I think that's exactly why he's always been the best option. Everybody was excited for the shiny new toy in Dwayne Haskins, who's going to be a great player, I have no doubt. But all that experience, winning, losing, going through battles, those are all things that Barrett has that go into that intangibles category that people kind of want to poo-poo when things aren't going great, but are what you absolutely need, and especially at that position. And I think, you know, again, for him to just have that game on that stage, I was just so happy. I mean, I'm a Buckeye fan, but I was just happy for him because it felt like some vindication for a guy who's been through a lot that wasn't all his own doing.
So they've rebounded from the Oklahoma loss almost all the way back up to number three now. Georgia is up at number two after Penn State lost. Penn State slips to 7 in both of the polls. So the top four are agreed upon between the AP and the coaches: Alabama, Georgia, the Buckeyes, and Wisconsin, another Big Ten team. Do you think that will be the first playoff ranking when the committee puts that out?
Well, that's a great question. Really hard to predict. I think, obviously, what's certain is that Alabama, Georgia will be 1-2. I think you could argue probably Georgia should even be 1 at this point, as meaningless as it all is. But after that, I mean, we'll see what they'll do. I think I would have Ohio State probably 3rd. I think where it's going to get interesting is 4th. I mean, if you follow the regular polls, yeah, Wisconsin would be up there. But, man, they have played nobody and are coming off, you know, only beating Illinois by, 14 or something like that, whereas Notre Dame has just been great the last couple weeks. I might be more inclined to put Notre Dame up there in the 4th slot ahead of Wisconsin if it was me, but I guess we'll find out tonight.
I'm with you. To be honest with you, I totally agree. I was wondering if anybody was going to say that. And, you know, and what's really strange about that, too, Chris, is when you know, Notre Dame oftentimes has been criticized by haters who don't like Notre Dame. You know, they always have this reputation. They, you know, even if they're overrated, if they have a sparkling record, they're going to be rated above everybody else in terms of the polls just because they are Notre Dame and they've got a name that sells and all that sort of thing. And I almost feel like that's kind of working against them now. And this time I think they literally are deserving of this. And there might be some saying, well, I'm not buying. I'm not going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But what they did to USC, not to mention the very, you know, easy victory, relatively speaking, over North Carolina State, another ranked team, I feel like Notre Dame has earned it. I feel like if the playoffs were tomorrow or, you know, next weekend, I feel like Notre Dame should be a part of it.
Yeah, I would agree. It pains me to say it. I am definitely not a Notre Dame fan and nor a Brian Kelly fan. And I mean, they're one loss.
I can't stand Brian Kelly. I cannot stand him. Mm-hmm. I don't like him. I don't like him as a person. I don't like him as a coach. But my goodness, he has found a way to get these guys playing well. I mean, I was ready to bury him, and I still wish they had a better coach. But and I'm not a Notre Dame fan either, by the way. I'm just, you know, this is a pure analyst position when I say I think they're worthy of this. I agree with you. I cannot stand Brian Kelly. I'm kind of ambivalent to Notre Dame. I don't hate him and I don't love him, but I do feel like that they deserve it right now.
Yeah, I would agree, and they've still got some tough games remaining, so if they continue to go through and finish with a loss, it's going to be inarguable that they should be in. So, you know, it's fun that we finally get a poll that matters, but at the end of the day, it still doesn't matter for, you know, another month or whatever it is, since there's still so much football left to play.
Yeah, they've got to go to Coral Gables, by the way, just to remind everybody. They got to go to Coral Gables on the 11th, November 11th does Notre Dame, and then they have got Stanford also on the road out in California on the 25th. So two ranked teams to go, and they still also have Wake and Navy, which presumably they should be able to take care of their business. But, yeah, they control their destiny probably to getting into the playoffs. I think that's fair to say. So the Buckeyes did exactly what they had to do. They needed this one over Penn State. Now they get Iowa, and Michigan State should be a bit of a challenge in that part of the conference. And then Illinois, which is one of the bottom feeders, and then Michigan, which looks very suspect in rebuilding as well. Do you think the Buckeyes have what it takes to run this table?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, they played a bunch of bad teams before the Penn State game, and they did exactly what good teams are supposed to do against bad teams, which is chew them up. And, you know, they were dominant in all those games and really built up a lot of confidence in areas where maybe they had, needed to regain some confidence after Oklahoma, most notably the passing game, most notably the right side of the offensive line. The secondary, you know, still has its moments here and there, or coverage in general, I guess should say, has had, you know, had some moments here and there that weren't great, but got to feel like everybody is feeling good beyond special teams right now that they should be able to run the table. And I would hope on the games that are remaining, saving Michigan, because that game could always, you know, it is true, you can throw out the records, but save that game. I feel like special teams being the worst I've ever seen probably still wouldn't be enough against an Iowa or a Michigan State, you know, to cost them a game, I wouldn't think.
You may have just answered the question for me. I was going to ask you, who's the bigger threat to them running the table and winning the Big Ten and going into the playoffs? Is it Sparty or is it Michigan?
Man, I don't know. Right now, I'd have to say Michigan State.
They lost. They just lost Saturday, by the way, to Northwestern. They had won four in a row. They lost to Notre Dame 38-18 earlier on, so they're 6-2. Michigan has also lost to Penn. As you know, they got blown out by the same Penn State team that Ohio State had to come back on yesterday, on Saturday.
Right.
You think Michigan State is a bigger worry?
It's truly a toss-up there. D'Antonio has just played Meyer so tough in his career up there. They're always such a physical team. They're like a dirty work team, not dirty, but they, you know, the way they play is very physical. You know, it's a backyard brawl kind of thing. And, you know, that always can, that can always be a little bit of a challenge. Who knows what the weather might be like on a day like that. Obviously, I mean, you know, going to Michigan, it's impossible to tell right now. Obviously, Michigan is down, but we'll have to see if Peters can be anything or not now that, it looks like they finally moved on from O'Korn. We'll see what Michigan do over the next couple weeks. I would imagine that'll be a battle, but if you took the names off the back of the jerseys right now, I think I'd be a little bit more worried about Michigan State than Michigan.
Last thing before you run, Chris Lauterbach, 11warriors.com, talking about the Buckeyes' big win over Penn State and projecting forward to the rest of this regular season. Did the Buckeyes cost Saquon Barkley the Heisman yesterday? Is Baker Mayfield maybe the leader going in here? Is JT Barrett suddenly a factor in it, do you think? Or is it still Barkley's award to lose?
Yeah, I don't know. I was never really quite sold that it was already his locked up. I mean, the season is just so long. It's easy to react to, you know, something when it happens for a few days until the next week comes and something crazy happens. But I think Barkley's a great player, to be sure. But, I mean, after Saturday, I would say that JT Barrett's numbers, I mean, 25 touchdowns against one interception. He's completing probably close to 70% of his passes. I mean, he's at the top of nearly every statistical, or at the top of nearly every quarterback ranking there is nationally right now. So, you know, you got to give that some credit. Barkley's a great player, but he's going to have to rebound. I think the Stanford kid, I know he missed this last week's game with injury,
nice
but
love.
Yeah, he's still a factor. And then Mayfield could be too, but I think Oklahoma's got a couple losses now. So unless he catches fire and Oklahoma catches fire, then Mayfield may not be quite in the conversation. It's too hard to tell because the criteria for this award is ridiculous. I mean, Jabril Peppers was somehow a finalist last year, and no one can convince me he was a top 10 player in college football last year. So I'm, you know, not really sure how it works sometimes. It's more popularity, I think, than anything.
Oklahoma has just the one loss, by the way, to Iowa State. They're 7-1. So Mayfield is still, and he's got that signature win over Ohio State, too, in which he played.
Right, right.
And he's got Oklahoma State coming up this week, by the way. Number 11 Oklahoma State, a big game there could really propel. In fact, back-to-back against Oklahoma State and TCU, who was upset by Iowa State as well. Matt Campbell, former head coach at Toledo, by the way, really doing incredible things in Ames, Iowa there at Iowa State. He took down Oklahoma and now
and TCU.
Yeah, two top 10 teams at the time they played them. Which is really, anyway, the point is Baker Mayfield still has a chance to put up big numbers against tough competition to advance.
Absolutely.
Well, but JT Barrett, your point is very well taken. 69.5% completion percentage, 25 TDs to the one pick. Some will say he feasted on that soft schedule in the middle, and he did. Of course, he could have also feasted bigger. If they had played him longer, he might have 40 touchdowns now against some of those teams that they played. So I think everything being considered, he certainly should be somebody that nobody sleeps on when it comes to the downtown, what's it called, Downtown Athletic Club, the Heisman Group. So we'll see. Listen, Chris, great talk. Really appreciate your analysis of everything that happened on Saturday and going forward, and we look forward to catching up again.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Lauterbach joining us right here on The Ticket, talking about the Buckeyes and their outstanding comeback win over Penn State on Saturday. Okay, here's what we got. We got a bottom of the hour Sports Center coming your way. On the way into that Sports Center, how about we do something awesome for you? I got a pair of tickets. If you would like to go see Joe Bonamassa on Monday the 27th of November, Monday the 27th at Stranahan Theater. You want a pair of tickets? Be caller 5 right now at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Then we'll get us a Sports Center, come right back, and talk to you right here on The Ticket.
Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Right back with you on The Extravaganza. Thanks again to our friends. Chris Lauterbach from 11warriors.com joined us, as well as Jeremy Reisman from prideofdetroit.com. Big loss for the Lions last night. Big win for the Buckeyes on Saturday. So we got all of that covered. Kush, I said we didn't have a lot of time in the first half hour, and we didn't. Really, in the last hour and a half, we didn't. But we should probably get there now and talk about the atrocity that is and are the Cleveland Cavaliers. And how about the pleasant surprise that is and are the Detroit Pistons starting this season? I don't want to say I had any preconceived notions on what the Pistons were going to be honest with you. Coming into this season, I didn't think they'd be world beaters, and I didn't think they'd be doormats. I just kind of thought middle of the road. Last year, it obviously was a kind of a step back. But they didn't start this year with any kind of, step back attitude or a feeling of we are not one of the elite teams, because the way they're playing, they're the best team in the Eastern Conference. They literally are the best team in the Eastern Conference record-wise now. At 5-2, you got a whole host of other teams at 4-2, but the Pistons took apart the world champion Warriors last night as well. What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on, I think, is since a week ago, last Monday, the Pistons dropped one to the Sixers at Little Caesars Arena, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was some talk of, and especially Stan Van Gundy after that game saying, you know, we're starting games, you know, awful, and you know, we're not having enough energy. And there was talk of a lineup change. So the first four games, Stanley Johnson was horrid, and I thought he was going to be the guy that got swapped in the lineup. They didn't do that, and he scored 15, 13, and 15 in the three games since for the Pistons. And this is an outstanding back-to-back over the weekend, almost forgetting that they beat the Clippers in Staples on Saturday night, but
and the Clips were still undefeated at the time.
Exactly. The Clips indeed were still undefeated at the time. And you heard Stan Van Gundy, you know, in the montage, you know, you look at Golden State's numbers, Clay with 29, he was hot. Durant had 28. Steph had 27. The Warriors as a team shot 57%. Everything I just said would make you think, oh, Warriors got this one. No problem, especially out at Oracle. And sure enough, by the way, they were up 8 on the Pistons, a 35-point first quarter. Even then, you would look at that and think, oh, but that might be it. But, you know, they hung with it. Andre Drummond had 18 rebounds in this one. 5 steals, by the way. You don't think of him as a steals guy. They're getting contributions from Ish Smith. As I mentioned, in these last three games specifically, all of them wins. Stanley Johnson, who looked horrible in the first four games and looked like he might get benched, he's gone out for double figures in both of them. Avery Bradley is doing the job they brought him in there to do, to be a secondary scorer in the backcourt and to provide some defense. And Reggie Jackson, honestly, I thought he had his best game overall of this young season. 22, 8 of 12 shooting. He had 5 assists. They are just clicking, you know, right now. And it's very, very nice to see. And yeah, it may not last because it's still so early. That's why we can have fun jokes about how it's not even November and the Cavs and Warriors have combined to lose 7 games already. And I'm not saying to Pistons fans, enjoy it while it lasts, but yeah, definitely enjoy the fact that as of right now, this moment, the Pistons are the number one team in the East.
Well, you know, specific to the game against the Warriors, I think we should probably point out the real reason. I mean, you kind of said, well, you know, if you think Kevin Durant scoring 28 and Steph Curry at 27 and Klay Thompson with 29, they're going to win. Well, they didn't. The Pistons didn't win this game by outplaying their starters. They won this game by outplaying their reserves. The bench scoring was the key. The Pistons outscored the Warriors bench 31. If my math is correct here, as I do a quick check, 31-19.
Yep, that's correct.
And, you know, the key is, I mean, if you just look at the plus minus, you know, if you look at, you know, Reggie Jackson, who might have had, you know, one of his best games, as you talked about, with 22 points and 5 assists and 3 rebounds, he was -3 in plus minus. Avery Bradley had 23 points and 3 steals and a couple of assists. He was -10. And Tobias Harris had 16 points. He was -13 with him on the court. When did they make hay? With Holliver on the court, plus 21. With Ish Smith on the court, plus 11, with Bullock on the court, plus 26. So it was clearly the bench that made the difference for the Pistons. And that depth is obviously a key in a very, very long season. And if you can get those kind of contributions, and they just didn't for Golden State. Typically, they do have a very solid bench. They only got 4 out of Iguodala. They got 4 out of West. They got 2 out of Sean Livingston. So, you know, these are guys who played 25, 15, and 12 minutes and just didn't do very much.
Yeah.
So
no,
either
that's
they were having
true.
Off nights or the Pistons played very good defense when their reserves were on the floor.
And I'm glad you mentioned that last part right there, the defense. I mean, we know the Warriors at times, especially when they're not on their game these past couple of years, even with, you know, bringing in Durant. What's one of the keys that you have to see in order to say, okay, now you got a chance? Careless with the ball. Golden State had 25 turnovers in that game last night. Yeah, even the Warriors can be beaten when they commit that many turnovers. And so that combined with the bench stuff is exactly why, you know, the Pistons ended up winning this game. And you got to like some of the things that they're able to do, you know, I think on the bench. And that's where you have the Ish Smith and Reggie Jackson talk that will probably at times, you know, continue. But all in all, it's very, very nice to see, particularly because around here, whether you're either more or less in the NBA circles anyway, you're either probably a Pistons fan or probably a Cavs fan. And at least when I'm watching the Pistons these past week, Bob, I'm seeing a team that's actually, you know, giving effort and has some energy. It's something I'm not seeing at all out of the Cavs, despite injuries or lineup changes. There's just a blatant lack of effort on the one,
totally,
and you're
agree.
Seeing it with the other right now.
We talked about that last week with one of our guests, Sam Amico.
Yes.
And I asked him, is that on Ty Lue to get that effort out of them, or is it on LeBron James, who is, you know, the coach on the court, the guy who constantly refers to everybody as being his guys. He's going to get his guys and do this and the other. Well, how come he's not getting his guys to play hard? Ty Lue said the effort, particularly on the defensive end, and also the mindset, is unacceptable after what is clearly an unacceptable loss to the New York
Knicks. And the last couple are unacceptable. And the only way we're going to be able to get is to put the work in as players, as coaches, and we're going to do that. So, you know, I'm not concerned. I mean, first game having D-Rose back. A little rusty, you know, as far as, you know, turning the ball up a little bit, but we need him to be aggressive, you know, playing with pace, not looking over his shoulder. So, but, you know, when you lose the teams, the way we've been getting beat, you know, it's unacceptable. Right now, I don't know if it's in shape wise or what, but we just, teams just look faster than we do at every position. So they're running fast, they're sprinting, they're pushing the ball up the floor, and it's like we can't keep up. Having a chance to play with great, you know, sometimes it's intimidating.
Now, this is the key. This is the part of the clip from the post-gamer that I really wanted you to hear from Tyronn Lue. First of all, the backdrop here is the run that they're on. They have lost now four games in their last five, and they've lost them, Jim, by an average of 16.8 points per game.
Ugh.
They are getting blown out. And those four losses are from four non-playoff teams from a year ago. Orlando, the Pelicans, the Nets, and the Knicks. Not in that order. Terrible, terrible teams. And they've been blown out by an average of 16.8 points a game. They've got a bunch of veterans. Jay Crowder, veteran. Derrick Rose, veteran, former MVP. Dwayne Wade, three-time champion, former MVP of the finals. They got a bunch of veteran guys. Kevin Love, of course, who's been here with LeBron for three. J.R. Smith, same story. You know, Iman Shumpert, Tristan, everybody is a veteran. And yet this is going to be where Ty Lue points the finger that maybe they're all afraid to play with LeBron. Wait, what? Give this a listen.
Great. You know, sometimes it's intimidating. And guys got to understand that, you know, LeBron, he's a given person. You know, he's a given player. So, you know, you got to come in, just play your game, and we'll adjust. I think a lot of times we defer to LeBron, or guys are scared to be aggressive, you know, because of that. But he's not that type of player at all. So we got to talk about that on Tuesday. Just guys being who you are, you know, being aggressive and playing your game.
You buying that? You buying any of that, Kush? Because I got to tell you,
no.
Dwayne Wade and LeBron James are best friends.
Yeah.
And they played together in Miami for 4 years, or 5 years, 4 years, 5 years, 2010, 11, 12, 13. He was back in Cleveland.
Yes, this is this was their fifth season together as teammates,
right,
whether
right,
in Cleveland
right,
or Miami.
They played four together in Miami.
Right.
So they know each other. If telling me Dwayne Wade is a little intimidated to be himself because he thinks LeBron might not like it, is Derrick Rose, who has never met a shot he didn't like, suddenly going to be like, I don't know if I should do this. I don't know if I should be aggressive. LeBron might not be happy. And first of all, I don't believe those things.
No, I don't either.
And second of all, if those things are true, if Tyronn Lue is correct and those things are to be believed, then what does that say about LeBron James? What does that say about him that he can't even get his guys to the level of comfort that they need to be at to go and play their games, that they're afraid of making him angry? There's no team meetings. There's no interpersonal relationship at practice that says, come on, man, take that shot. Come on, man, do this, do that. You know, be yourself, score. We need this, we need that. You're telling me these guys can't figure all of that out together to the point where this 3-4 basketball team losing four games by an average of 16.8 points per game are clearly the biggest underachiever in the National Basketball Association to date?
I mean,
I don't buy that.
Yeah, I'm not buying this one either, that they're intimidated to play with him. I that's hogwash to me. I think what's closer is kind of something that I said, and Tyronn Lue kind of, sort of, you know, nudged at in a different line that we played earlier in the montage, saying, you know, this is unacceptable, and it is. Mm-hmm. But what he's not saying, because, you know, coaches aren't really supposed to say that necessarily to the media guys, is this goes back to the effort. You know, they're not giving the effort once again on defense, and we saw how at times trends about that last year ended up that if there's one thing that carried over from that from the regular season last year, if you recall, through the postseason, it was the defense was still not good. And what have we said many times? A lot of basketball defense specifically is about effort. They're not showing it there. He did mention something else that is completely correct, and this goes, I think, to, among other things, them being the Cavs being the oldest team in the NBA right now. They're getting beaten up in terms of speed and energy type things. This is why a game like last night, when the other team is trying to run and trying to use their energy, the guys like, I don't know, Tristan Thompson have to actually do the things that they're being paid to do, which is energy. I mean, we know it's not for offense. You know, we know it's not for things like assists or even really shot blocking. He's there to provide energy and rebounding. He's giving you none of that right now. Guys are still not shooting overall that well. This team was 38% last night in this game, you know, from the field. 10 three-pointers made, which feels like one of the better three-point shooting days out of this team so far this season. And, yeah, there's still some guys there that are newer, and they have to figure out where the pieces fit the best. And we've said time and again, starting with the preseason a couple weeks ago, up to and including right now, that at least for this first month and a half, really to the end of November at the minimum, this team is going to struggle at times, just like last night, as they're trying to figure things out. But there's no excuse for the lack of the energy and the lack of the effort, especially on the defensive end, that I'm seeing all over again, just like last year.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's very, very frustrating, to say the least. Hey, Kush, it's 4:55, and I know we got drive time coming up. Before you play the music, I want to do this. I want to pay a little bit of respect, a little tribute, a little homage to one of the greatest nights in the history of pugilism. October 30th, 1974. This happened.
Right hand by Pullman was not effective. The right uppercut did bounce the head a little bit. His punches will not hurt Ali. Ali just takes him, protecting his face at all times, does Ali. Pullman throwing more punches now. Maybe this could be the tactic of Ali, to let the man punch himself out.
30 seconds left in round 8. Very even fight. Ali, a sneaky right hand. Another sneaky right hand. This time he works over the shoulder of Pullman.
This night, 1974, Muhammad Ali ropes his dope and takes out George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle. One of the greatest nights in the history of boxing. One of my favorite moments, honestly, of all time in sports. Watching and listening to that again is just an absolute pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. Do yourself a favor. Go home tonight, wherever you are. Go home tonight and get on YouTube and look up the Rumble in the Jumble and watch it, just in celebration of one of the great moments in boxing history. That's it. That's all the time that I've got. Thanks for the great conversation today. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to you, Kush. Drive time is coming up next. We'll see you tomorrow.